Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 12, short chapter this time, verses 1 through 16. We're going to talk about Miriam and Aaron's revolt against Moses. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 11, we see the people complaining. Doesn't say why they're complaining at first. Then God put a fire in the outskirts of the camp. Taberah it was called, which means burning. And then they complained again because they got tired of the manna, so God gave them a plague. So two complaints and two punishments. So now we begin Numbers 12, verses 1 and 2. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it. Now Miriam is listed first between Miriam and Aaron, and that gives some people indication that probably she is the one that took the lead in instigating this rebellion. She was the one that caught the leprosy. She's mentioned first. Yeah, she probably took the lead. Now, Gil makes the point that it's really tough to have your sister and your brother fighting you in a bad place. Remember, the Israelites are grumbling like crazy. They've already had two bad punishments put on them. Moses got upset with God. He said, "Just kill me. I don't want to live anymore if it's going to be like this." And then his own brother and sister turn against him. Things are not going well for our brother Moses. Now, the reason for their rebellion is given here because of the Cushite woman that Moses had married. Now, some people say, and in fact, the NIV Study Bible says this pretty directly, is that the attack on the Cushite woman was a pretext. They weren't really upset with Moses because he married a Cushite woman. They were upset because of what they said in verse 2, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses?" In other words, they were jealous because Moses had the leadership and they didn't. Now, where have we heard that before? Is not the whole sordid history of politics about people who wanted power? Well, let's look at the possibility that this idea that the NIV Study Bible has might be wrong. Maybe it was because they were upset with a Cushite woman that married Moses. Why would they be upset with that? Well, Cushite is somewhere to the south of Egypt, probably Ethiopia. Jameson Fawcett Brown said the Ethiopians were considered a vile and contemptible race. They quote Amos 9:7, "Are you not as the sons of Ethiopia to me, O sons of Israel?" In other words, these guys are really bad pagans down there, and you Israelites are reminding me of Ethiopians. That might be, or you could say that maybe they just didn't like the Cushite woman. Maybe not because she was from Cush, but because they just didn't like her. Or maybe it didn't matter. The real reason was that they wanted power, and they didn't like the fact that they had lost it. Now, why might Aaron and Miriam be jealous of Moses? Well, the NIV Study Bible says, for his prophetic gift, he was a prophet, as you know. Deuteronomy 18:18, "The Lord will raise up a prophet like me." Could be because of Moses' special relationship with God, as we'll see in this chapter. He has a very close relationship with God, and the brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, were jealous of that. Could be Aaron and Miriam were peeved because the 70 elders, which took away some of Moses' power, and therefore, by derivation, some of Aaron and Miriam's power in the previous chapter, those 70 elders were prophesying all over the place. Aaron and Miriam didn't prophesy. And so Aaron and Miriam might be jealous because they lost some power. Moses lost power, and they lost power because they were associated with Moses. And notice, when the 70 elders were appointed in the previous chapter, Moses had not consulted Aaron and Miriam, and so as God Gill points out, they probably weren't happy about it. Well, for whatever reason, as we see in this story, it was stupid. There was no excuse for them to be upset with Moses. He had enough trouble on his plate to have this going on. Now, this Cushite woman that Moses married, we don't know who she was. Some people say she was Zipporah. That was Moses' first wife. Favoring that idea is Miriam and Aaron could say, "Look, Zipporah is married to Moses, and Zipporah's father is Reuel, Jethro. And Jethro came into the camp, and he told Moses in Exodus 18 that Moses needed to decentralize the leadership, take power away from leadership, to let subordinate judges do their work." And so through that connection, maybe Miriam and Aaron said, "Well, that's why things are decentralized now. That's why power's not in our family anymore. It's because of old Jethro." And who's Jethro's daughter? Cushite, and so the Cushite woman, Zipporah. And so now Jethro's got too much control over Moses, and he's taking too much power away from Moses and thus from us. Now, that's a lot of highfalutin speculation. I don't know whether it's true or not. Some people say the Cushite woman was just some other Cushite woman. NIV Study Bible says that. they say that another Cushite woman is probably who it is, because that's more likely than Zipporah. And this new Cushite woman could have come after the death of Zipporah, perhaps. We don't know. But at any rate, that's incidental detail, folks. The main point here is there's rebellion in the land, and God heard it. At the end of verse 2, he says, and the Lord heard it. Now notice in verse 2 that both Moses and Miriam said this: has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? Well, now, as a matter of fact, God had spoken through Miriam and Moses, but that still didn't give him the right to start a rebellion. It seems like rebellion is a key word here in Exodus. Remember Nadab and Abihu did the strange fire, and then later on we're going to see Korah's rebellion. Now we got Moses, Aaron and Miriam's rebellion. Poor old Moses. People were always rebelling against him. Well, but Aaron and Miriam were right that God has spoken through them. Micah 6:4, indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt and ransomed you from the house of slavery. And I, that's Yahweh, sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. See, God gave Aaron and Miriam co-credit there. Exodus 4:15 and 16, you are to speak to him, to Aaron, and put the words in his mouth. And I, even I, will be your mouth, this is God speaking, will be your mouth, Moses, and his mouth, Aaron, and I will teach you what you are to do. So God has used Aaron and Miriam, and he uses Aaron. In fact, Aaron had a lot of duties as the high priest, so there was no excuse for this revolt. We read in Exodus 15:20, Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. Timbrels like a tambourine. And so she was called a prophetess here, so that means God spoke through her in Exodus 15:20. So, yeah, Miriam and Aaron were appealing to what God had done through them, but just because God's done something through you, that doesn't give you the right to be rebellious. We go down to Numbers 12:3. Now, the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. Now, this verse is always quoted by people who say, see, Moses couldn't have written that. It must have been an editor that put that in there. Because if he's a humble man, why would he brag so much in this verse? That sounds self-contradictory. I'm not so sure of that. Well, why would a humble man brag so much? Here's some options to solve that problem. Option number one, as I just mentioned, perhaps this was a later addition to the text. It was inserted by an editor to compare Moses to the humble Moses to the arrogance of Miriam and Aaron, who unfairly charged Moses. Well, that's the standard solution. Here's another, I think, off-the-wall solution. Adam Clark, he says, the verse could be translated this way. Now, the man Moses was very depressed, more than any other man who was on the face of the earth. Not that he was humble, but that he was depressed. If you're thinking about it, humble and depressed are sort of close. And so Moses is depressed because of the rebellion of Miriam and Aaron. Interesting idea. I don't really think that's the answer. Option number three, which I do think is the answer, in my humble opinion, Moses was forced to talk about how humble he was because of the circumstances. He had to talk about how humble he was to make Miriam and Aaron look like rebels who deserved their punishment. And that's why he had to talk about how humble he was, to show that there was no reason for Miriam and Aaron to be revolting. Now, the Apostle Paul had to do that. It was distasteful, but he had to do it. 2 Corinthians 11:5. For I, Paul, consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. He was bragging, but he had to stand up for his apostleship. Perhaps Moses could be standing up for his leadership of Israel here. 2 Corinthians 12:11-12, Paul says, I have become foolish. You yourselves compelled me. Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am a nobody. Well, he was a little humble there, but he did say he was inferior to the most eminent apostles. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles. So sometimes you gotta state your authority, even though it makes you sound proud. And it's like when you're writing a resume trying to get a job, and they say, well, if you don't toot your horn, nobody else is going to toot it. And it's embarrassing. I remember I've been going through this, writing resumes. Oh, man, it sounds so braggadocious. But you know, sometimes you gotta do that. You gotta try to do it humbly. But you still got to do it. All right, Paul, he throws in here, I'm a most eminent apostle, even though I'm a nobody. You know, he does kind of soften it a little bit. Now, what are some examples of Moses' humility? Well, he shared power with those 70 prophets that we mentioned last chapter. He didn't care when Eldad and Medad prophesied in the camp. The other 68 were prophesying around the tabernacle. Eldad and Medad go into the camp and prophesy, and somebody saw it, a young man, I think it was Joshua, heard about it. went to Moses and says, hey, they prophesied in the camp without your authority. And Moses says, I don't care. That's fine. I wish everybody could prophesy. So that shows his humility. He told God he wasn't a speaker. He didn't want to lead when God chose him to lead Israel. God gave him Aaron to speak for him. His children, Moses' children, are never mentioned in his genealogies. All the other tribal leaders have all their genealogies pasted right there in the Bible, but not Moses. He let Aaron be the high priest, even though Moses was head of the whole nation. Moses prayed for the people when they sinned, Numbers 21:7. So the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. He was humble. Deuteronomy 9:18. I fell down before the Lord as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin. This is referring to the golden calf incident back at Sinai. All your sin which you had committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. And so not only did Moses pray for the Israelites, he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. I don't think I could have done that. Let's sum up Moses's humility with a quote from John Gill. Quote, being seldom angry, and when he was, it was generally, if not always, when the honor of God was concerned, and not on account of his own person and character, though it must not be said of him that he was perfect in this respect, or free from passion, or from blame at any time on account of it, but when compared with others, he was the meekest man that ever lived, whereby he became the fittest person to have to do with such a peevish, perverse, and rebellious people as the Israelites were, whom no other man could well have bore with. We go now to Numbers 12, verses 4 through 8. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, you three come out to the tent of meeting. Apparently they were in the camp. Shekinah glory is hovering over the tabernacle as always. All of a sudden there's this voice. Come here, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So the three of them came out. That means they went into the courtyard of the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down on a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent. That's in the courtyard. That's not the doorway that leads from the courtyard to the camp, but the doorway that leads from the courtyard into the holy place. And that's where the Lord came down. He stood there and he called Aaron and Miriam, and he stood there because they couldn't actually go into the tabernacle. It wasn't allowed because Moses was not a priest. And he called Aaron and Miriam. When they had both come forward, God had called them. God said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? So here we have God building up Moses' leadership and authority and saying, Aaron and Miriam, how in the world can you speak against Moses? Verse 4 says, suddenly the Lord said to the three. The abruptness of the Lord's response instilled terror, says the NIV Study Bible. The suddenness of it was to quickly quell the sedition. That makes sense. There's rebellion going on. The suddenness of it signified God's displeasure, as Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown says. Now, they're standing at the doorway of the tent of meeting where the Shekinah glory is. Usually that cloud is on the top of the tabernacle and comes down to the Holy of Holies. It was there all the time. People could see it at night. But this time, it was at the doorway where everybody could see it, closer to the camp. God wanted Miriam and Aaron to be rebuked in front of everybody because what they did was a public sin. It doesn't say that, but we can assume that people heard it, that there was rumbling in the ranks, that there was rebellion being formed. So this doorway became a tribunal, just like the gates of the ancient cities of the ancient Near East. This doorway was a judgment place. Now, what God said here in verse 6 is in the form of a poem. I don't really care, but lots of commentators love this literary stuff. So what's the poem say? This, I'm sure in Hebrew it was a poem. Verse 6, he said, hear now my words, if there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. Doesn't sound like a poem to me. Not very poetic translation. Now, what verse 6 means is the ordinary prophet's got to look in a vision, which means he's asleep. He's looking in a trance kind of, and he's seeing all these symbolic things. He's got to figure out what it is. He's not really talking to God face to face. Or in a dream, he's not even awake. He's asleep. Again, symbolic things. What do they say? I don't know. Got to search. Not so with God. I mean, God just talked to Moses and said, this is what you do. I want you to build a tabernacle this way. This many poles, this many hooks. No symbolism there. Straight out. John Gill points out, here's some examples of Old Testament prophets that had symbolism to deal with. The almond tree rod, the boiling pot, that was Jeremiah. Visions of the chariots in Ezekiel, the valley of the dry bones also in Ezekiel. And the visions of a man riding on a red horse in Zechariah 1. The vision of the four horns in Zechariah 1. The four carpenters in Zechariah 1. That's a very symbolic book. That's a difficult book. But that's not Moses. Moses was probably the greatest prophet of all. God came down and talked to him just like I'm talking to you now. Now in verse 8, the text says that when I, God, speak mouth to mouth, he beholds the form of the Lord. Moses beholds the form of the Lord. Well, how can you see God? Now see, that's a problem because nobody can see the face or the essence of God, as James from Fawcett and Brown rightly and correctly point out. Now here's some scriptures, three, that tell us that we can't see God. Exodus 33:20, but he, God, said, you cannot see my face. You, Moses, cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. What happened right after that in verse 33, a couple verses down, we read this, and when my, God's, glory passes by, I, God, will put you in the crevice of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away, and you will see my back, but my face will not be seen. So, not really seeing the form of God, you're seeing the back of God. Colossians 1:15, he is the image of the invisible God, the invisible God, the invisible God. That means you can't see him. John 1:18, no one has seen God at any time. So, if no one has seen God at any time, and God's the invisible God, and you can't see his face and live, why does it say in verse 8 that Moses, quote, beholds the form of the Lord, end quote? Well, the answer to that is that Moses did see God, but only in God's veiled form. He didn't see God in his essence, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. Also, gotquestions.org mentions that too in a little essay they have. And the best verse that shows that we can't see God in his essence is verse 23 of Exodus 33. This is when Moses wanted to see God, and God said, nope, can't see me, but I'll put you in the rock. In verse 23, then I will take my hand away, and you will see my back, but my face will not be seen. So basically, you're seeing God in a veil form, and that's the way he puts it. See God's back instead of his front. And that makes sense. How in the world could anybody see God and live? God's got to veil himself. What was the incarnation? That was a veiling of God. Jesus was God, but he was veiled in the flesh. He was incarnate, so you could look at him without getting fried. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest a different translation here that would say, even openly, not in dark speeches, he beholds the Lord as in a figure, and in a figure shall he behold the Lord. In other words, he beholds the Lord in some kind of metaphor. I don't think so. That seems to me to cut against the whole thrust of the passage, which is trying to build up Moses. So he says, look, he can see me, can't see me face to face, but he can see my form. Even though it's my backside, the prophets, they've never seen my front side or my backside. They've never seen me at all. So anyway, let's don't get sidetracked. The point is to build up Moses in the face of Miriam and Aaron's rebellion. Numbers 12:9-12. So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous. That means she had a skin disease, not necessarily leprosy. It's a bad translation, the NASB. Miriam had a skin disease as white as snow. As Aaron turned toward Miriam, behold, she had a skin disease. Then Aaron said to Moses, O my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us, in which we have acted foolishly, and in which we have sinned. Oh, do not let her be like one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes from his mother's womb. That's a good picture of a baby when he's first born, his flesh half eaten away. I've often said babies are the ugliest things you ever saw when they come. I've seen three of my babies, and I love my children. In fact, the boy's handsome, and the two girls are really pretty, but they weren't when they were born. Heads shaped like a cone. They got blood streaked all over them. This greasy blue, what do they call that, vernix or something? Blue stuff that's spread all over them. But everybody says, oh, aren't they cute? Reminds me of people far out in the West when they get a mail order bride, and these girls come out there looking like the Wicked Witch of the East, Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz. And they come out there and they say, oh, you're beautiful. So, but anyway, verse 12, Aaron is saying to Moses, oh man, don't let Moses look like one of these newborn babies. He was realistic about the way those newborn babies looked. Looked like half their flesh is eaten away, and Miriam's going to get her skin eaten away. Oh, And of course, he's appealing to his brother. Please, brother, his blood brother. Now, the Shekinah glory had withdrawn from over the tent. Verse 10, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the Shekinah glory probably left the doorway, went back to his resting place over the mercy seat in the tabernacle, which is probably true. John Gill says that the Shekinah glory left the tabernacle completely. Wasn't it over the mercy seat or at the doorway? So God's so angry, he just leaves. Gill says that the Shekinah glory went up higher in the air or removed at some distance from thence, which was a further indication of the sore displeasure of God, that as he would not stay with Aaron and Miriam at the door of the tabernacle, so neither would he suffer the cloud to continue over it, as it was wont to do as long as they were there. Now let's look at this skin disease that Miriam had. We need to remember what a tragic thing it was to have these serious skin diseases. If you recall the movie Ben-Hur, Ben-Hur's mother and sister had, well, they called it leprosy. They had the skin disease, and oh, when Jesus healed it, it was wonderful. I still remember it. I remember where I was. I was in room A509 at the Bates House at the University of South Carolina. I had a black and white portable TV. I was watching Ben-Hur for the first time. It took me forever. I was in college before I saw it. And at the end of that movie, when they got healed, I'll never forget it. Cried like a baby. Now, God put this disease on Miriam. Now, that's a good answer to those who say that God would never put a disease on someone. Now, you hear that a lot in the charismatic movement, at least I did. Only the devil would do that. Hold on, Manichaeism here, you know. Only the devil would do that. Any bad thing has to come from the devil. All good things have to come from God. Of course, that completely ignores the fact sometimes God uses evil to bring good about. Happens all the time. Romans 8:28. And besides, I have explicit scriptures here that show that God put diseases on people. Exodus 4:6. The Lord furthermore said to Moses, now put your hand into your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow, or his hand had a skin disease like snow. Well, who put that skin disease on Moses' hand? That would be the Lord. Unless you're saying the Lord's just sitting there watching and says, okay, I'm just going to let the devil do it now. Knowing some of these faith message characters, I wouldn't be surprised they would say that. 2 Kings 5:27, therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you, says Elijah. Cling to you, Gehazi, who is his servant, and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. So Elijah the prophet, he was the one that put the disease on him, but of course that was through working through God. Miriam might have been the very first leper or person with a skin disease since the law concerning skin disease was given. And so Moses would have to call on a priest to pronounce her unclean. Oh, that would have been a great mortification, as John Gill says. He could have just gotten another priest to do it rather than doing it himself, but he still had to do it. Aaron says in verse 12, Moses, don't let her be like one dead. And when dead, that means cut off from the community, because that's what you had to do when you're a leper. You had to go through the ritual. You had to be quarantined, basically, outside the camp in the leper colony. We go now to Numbers chapter 12, verses 13 through 14. Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, O Lord, healer, I pray. Now Moses was quick to respond to Aaron's importunity. It was his sister. He didn't want to see his sister eaten up with disease, and so he prays to God to heal her. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterward she may be received again. Now, how did the Lord say this to Moses? Either with an audible voice, or maybe just put an impulse upon his spirit. I think it's an audible voice because it's so precise. Spitting in your face, but that's not in the scriptures, by the way. If someone is spitting in their face, they have to bear their shame for 7 days. That came from, let me read from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The Jews, in common with all people in the East, seem to have had an intense abhorrence of spitting, and for a parent to express his displeasure by doing so in the person of one of his children, or even on the ground in his presence, separated that child as unclean from society for 7 days. So in other words, you may make a child unclean by spitting in his feet. If you make your daughter unclean by spitting in her face, or any woman for that matter, she's going to have to be set aside from the community for 7 days. And if a woman who is shamed for that when it's not even her fault, how do you compare that to Miriam, whose fault it was? Her rebellion. She's got to take some public blame for this, some opprobrium for what she has done. Now notice that this shows that God knows how to temper mercy with justice and justice with mercy. He's the just judge. He says, no, we're not just going to heal her right now. we're going to wait 7 days and she's going to go through the ritual so everybody can see that what she did was not a good thing. That's why these people that say that there's no hell, these people have no idea of how horrible the human race is. They have no heart. They are walking in complete denial. And when I say the human race, I mean them. I don't care how goody two-shoes they are. They are wealthy, wicked, wretched, filthy, nasty, poisonous rebels against God. And it's only by God's grace that he would even think about saving us or some of us. But the people who shake their hands at God, not the goody two-shoes, but those who are just deliberately rebellious against him, there's no place hot enough in hell for people like that. They deserve it. So again, God is a just God. He gives plenty of time for repentance, but if you're going to insist on not repenting, the axe is going to fall. Well, fortunately, here's some mercy. 7 days. I mean, that's bad, but it's not the end of the world. Miriam's received back into Moses' good company. We go now to Numbers 12, verses 15 and 16. Well, let me stay on these verses here for a minute. The idea of spitting, that's a sign of the deepest contempt. That's the same as our culture, really. Job 30:10, they abhor me and stand aloof from me, and they do not refrain from spitting at my face, says Job in his misery. Isaiah 50, verse 6, I gave my back to those who strike me and my cheeks to those who pluck out the beard. I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting. Of course, that's Jesus speaking in Isaiah. Mark 14:65, some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him and so forth and said, prophesy, who hit you? So spitting is a terrible thing. The 7 days of leprosy was standard. The 7 days was also the standard time of uncleanness and coming in contact with a dead body. Seven is the number of divine perfection, of course. But anyway, Miriam's cured of leprosy, so it makes sense that she would have to go through that ritual, which is described in Leviticus 13. Let me read verse 5 in Leviticus 13. The priest shall look at him, the leper, on the seventh day, and if in his eyes the infection has not changed and the infection has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall isolate him for 7 more days. Now we can go to Numbers 12, verses 15 and 16. So Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on until Miriam was received again. Now remember, where are they now? They're not at Kibroth Hataava, the field, the graves of lust, where they got struck with a plague because of the quail. They stayed there for 30 days, eating quail till they were sick of it and got the plague till it came out of their nostrils. And they went north for 7 days and stayed at Hazeroth. And it was at Hazeroth that the people had to stay and wait on Miriam as she was quarantined. Afterward, verse 16, afterward Miriam was received back into the community, the people moved out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. Now, if you look at the Mount Sinai and look at the Gulf of Aqaba, which runs up the eastern side of Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai is sort of down near the tip, and as you go up the coast of the Gulf of Aqaba in the middle of the peninsula there, you go to Kibroth Hataava, then you go to Hazeroth. You're still sort of in the Sinai Desert, but then you go a little bit north, you get right to the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, maybe a little bit north of that tip, and you're in the wilderness of Paran, and that's where they are. And they were just right, you know, they got to go through one more desert, the wilderness of sin, and then they would go into the Negev, and they'd be in Israel, and, but oh no, they should have done it in a couple months. They ended up spending 38 years because of their sin. Why did the people not move at Hazeroth for 7 days? Well, they were waiting for Miriam. I think that's obvious. John Gill suggests another reason. They didn't have a cloud to direct them because the cloud had left and had departed. God's angry. I don't think so. I think God went right back into the Holy of Holies and lived back between the, or stayed between the two cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant. All right, we'll leave the Israelites there in the wilderness of Paran. Now we're ready to go into Numbers chapter 13, verses 1 through 33 in the next audio. We're going to see the famous story of the spies being sent out to Canaan to see all the giants. Hope you stay tuned for that exciting audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.